The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 183 for December 29th, which, John, I think is the Festivus of New Year's Day, right? Because it's the day before New Year's. 2008. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton. I'm here with John Braun. How are you, John?
Good. You had a little pause there. That was not due to technical difficulties. I guess you're straddling the years here.
That's right. Yeah. The space-time continuum has a rift in it, and I was attempting to navigate that.
To take the big leap.
That's right. That's pilot.
Well, I'm putting together our schedule to kind of give us some semblance of organization, and I had trouble typing 2009, so I'm in the same boat.
Well, truth be told, it was neither technical nor a calendar related issue. It was more just getting my mouse to the point where after I said eight, I could click the fire off the song for the intro, but I didn't want anybody to know. So that's why I sort of just dragged it out. I wanted it to be all smooth. Anyway, in addition to having the year change upon us here, and I don't think we set the clocks back this time, John. I think we just leave them alone, right?
Well, I do believe they're adding a quarter second.
Oh, they are. It's a whole second, I thought.
Or is it a whole second? I thought it was a quarter second.
Yeah. Time stops.
Oh, I thought they had quarter. Second. Oh, okay. Or I guess every 4 years. Yeah. Okay. A leap second, right?
Yeah.
So the good news is if your watch runs fast, you don't have to do anything. You're totally golden. But we have an event next week. We got to get on airplanes shortly after the ball drops there, John. In fact, I'm leaving on Friday. I hope we're supposed to get snow, but we're all heading out to Macworld Expo next week. Right, John?
Absolutely. Oh, boy.
And so we have some tips both from us, from the three of us. In fact, both John and I have created some tips, and Pilot Pete, being a veteran of air travel, has some air travel tips for us and for you. We have some tips from listeners. And then, of course, we have all sorts of questions of yours and tips of yours to share. Some stuff following up from last week's show and some questions that are all brand new and all that good stuff. I think we need to get right into these tips here, right, John? Don't you think?
Let's dive in.
Let's go. Robert has some to share.
Hey, it's Robert from New Jersey again, and I'm going to wink, wink, say no more one more time. Tips for Macworld. The obvious is comfy shoes, and I think I gave this tip last year, which was oatmeal. You stick oatmeal in your bag. If you're real busy and you get hungry, all you need is a little hot water and a spoon, and you've got a quick little meal. So instant oatmeal packs in your bag, a definite. I don't eat them, but I know here's another little quick meal would be an energy bar. I don't like them because they're not as healthy for you. They're usually very fattening and loaded with sugar and all kinds of junk. So if I think of any others, I'll let you know. Bye.
Excellent. Thank you, Robert. Those are all fantastic tips. Oatmeal is, and I think I said this last year after Robert shared it last year, but oatmeal is one of my travel staples. I always, always bring some. And if you've got a coffee maker in the hotel room, even better. You can actually cook the oats and they don't have to, you know, sort of cook inside your belly.
Yeah. What I think may be better is, so I agree with him. Energy bars are probably like sugar. And I think actually a lot of them have a lot of alcohol in them to provide energy. But
really?
But I think there are another class, protein bars, which I think may be a little better for you in that, you know, it's filling you up.
There you go.
All right. But yeah, I mean, you know, to keep it, because I've noticed, but when I travel, as you know, as we're all getting older, but, you know, if I'm not fed at the right time, I start getting real cranky and real run down. So
it happens. I know I get that way too. All right. David from MacSparky.com writes, he said, "Hey, John and Dave, while this may seem obvious, one bit of advice for Macworld attendees is to say hello and make friends with the person next to you. Whether you're taking a class, prowling the exhibit hall, or just eating a sandwich, the people at Macworld are really nice, and you may learn a thing or two. In fact, saying hello to a stranger is exactly how I met John at last year's Cirque du Mac." So there you go.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So you might just meet John Braun the John F. Braun, not some imposter. But if you turn and say hi, it could be John.
I don't have to deal with that problem yet, nor do I hope I ever have to.
Okay, so some of my tips. One of my favorite ones for any sort of travel and trade shows, especially, is drink plenty of water. You will not realize, or likely may not realize, how much water your body is just kind of burning through. You're up, you're out, you're traveling, it's dry. That trade show air is just kind of going to suck the water out of you. So you may not even be sweating or realizing you're sweating, but that water leaves, especially if you're standing a lot and walking around. So drink lots and lots of water. The last thing you want to do is notice that you're thirsty. Better to stay ahead of it. So drink plenty of water. As a follow-up to Robert's tip and John's tip, eat breakfast every day. That's another one of my favorite ones. It really kind of, you know, keeps you from getting burned out. Bring an umbrella. Even though the show is mostly in the North and South halls this year, which is a good thing, especially compared to last year, there are still many, many things. All the classes and everything are over in West Hall, but, which means you have to go outside to get there, but you also have to go outside to get to and from your hotel and all of that stuff. So bring an umbrella at this time of year. You never know what you're going to run into there. It's a little late for this piece of advice, but book rooms and flights as early as you can. And it's January. So, you know, as a rule, I try not to fly through Chicago or Denver if I can avoid it. There are lots of great sessions at Macworld Expo. I know a lot of you go only for the exhibits and the, you know, parties and all that stuff, but there are some fantastic sessions happening. Some of them, they've even moved a lot of them actually to the show floor. So you can really get a taste of what all that conference is about. Go check those out. I know we talked about some of those with Paul Kent in the podcast I did with him earlier this month, but that the sessions are fantastic. And lastly, if you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch, go to the App Store and download iMacWorld. You can find it at tinyurl.com/iMacWorld. It'll get you there. Fantastic little app. They're actually updating it with maps and everything, so you can find where you want to be on the show floor, and they can get messages out to you. Great little handy thing. So those are my tips, John.
Okay. Some of these will follow up on yours, and some are new. Avoid diuretics such as coffee or alcohol, or if you do consume those. And basically, those are chemicals that make you get rid of water quicker than your body really should. So try to avoid those, or offset with drinking water. Maybe bring your own bottle instead of buying bottled water, because bottled water, kind of all the energy it takes. I don't know. I think the San Francisco water probably won't kill you. So you just bring your own bottle and refill it. That's a nice thing to do. Put your phone on vibrate, okay? How many times do we have to tell you people? I'm just thinking in the keynote, there's going to be some...
Dave's putting his phone on vibrate as we speak, John.
I'm serious. There's always someone in the keynote or the conference hall that has their phone. And sometimes it is funny sometimes, because it's a really embarrassing dial tone. You know, some, you know, hardcore rap tune for someone that doesn't look hardcore rap. But anyways, moving on. Bring a portable wireless access point like Airport Express.
And
we'll talk about this a little later. We have a question, so I'll just say bringing one of those may be helpful if either the hotel doesn't offer wireless, or you don't want to use theirs, or they have a wired connection and you'd like to extend it and not be stuck at your desk. Don't party like a teenager unless you are one or in your early 20s. Just take it easy. Don't try to go to every party. I tried to do that once and it wasn't pretty.
You know, I know you've got more, but I'm going to follow on to that one, John, if you don't mind. 3 years ago, I had Bell's palsy, I got Bell's palsy early December. And, of course, you know, it like any illness like that, stress is a major contributor to, it coming on and of course it staying around too long. So I knew I had to go to Macworld Expo, but I also knew I didn't want to totally tax out my body. So I made a curfew for myself of 10 p.m. every night. Mm-hmm. And I knew that the night of Cirque du Mac, our party, that I simply could not honor that curfew. Right. So that was fine. But every other night I made a curfew at 10 p.m. I did everything I needed to that week. I even made it to the parties I wanted to make it to, and yet was still in my room at 10 p.m. asleep by, 11, 11:30. after puttering around and just winding down for the day. And I felt great after I came back from that Macworld. So it is possible to do a lot. Let me tell you, I do a ton that week, and I was still able to be back in my room by 10 p.m. So, you can do everything and anything at Macworld and still not totally kill yourself. So sorry for the interruption, but
that's a good one. It actually makes me think of one is, try to, again, I'll be doing this, in part for the group here, but, go through the exhibitor list, kind of get a plan of who you want to see and when you want to see them, list the events. There are a lot of resources on the, Macworld Expo site to help you know what is happening when, try to do a little organization so you see everything you want, and don't miss out on anything. I'll skip that. Remember to travel light. Don't grab everything that people try to hand you, though. I think a lot of vendors tend to not do this as much anymore because you can get it online. You don't need a disc or a big catalog or stuff like that. Of course, swag like, little bouncing balls and T-shirts and stuff like that you may need. But again, try to travel light because you got to put it somewhere if you're going to be flying back. And you don't want to pay more for your suitcase. I found this, David, maybe this is more for press people, but it could be for anybody. Don't be rude, but don't be afraid to break away from a vendor that turns it into a monologue. I've had this happen sometimes, and it's always kind of weird to detach yourself where you just feel obligated to listen to a 5-minute spiel. And you're like, I gotta run. I don't know about you, but I've had it happen. It's weird.
Yeah.
I head to the back of the hall. I would the big guys. When I first come in, I'll rush right by Apple. I'll rush by all the people that have the big booths and probably paid big bucks. Because I want to find the little gems, the little interesting things. And for example, a lot of them that got our editor's choice last year were the people that I and others on the staff found in the back of the place on the little things where they maybe have just a table. Try that. Special interest areas. They always have a different mix of them every year. Trying to find a hotel where maybe Macworld staff or vendors or something are staying because there may be something going on that you may stumble across. Bring extra batteries for everything. Computer, camera. I have 2 batteries for my computer, 3 for my camera, and I have run out of camera sometimes in the middle of the day, especially with flash pictures or a small camera that doesn't take full-size batteries. Get another or a bigger memory card. You may run out of space. Take way more pictures than you need. You may find out you're all out. Because, again, I've had that happen sometimes. Fill out the feedback forms for the sessions that you go to, like Dave will speak about one shortly that he's doing, or ours. If there are feedback forms, it helps both you as the attendee and the presenters as well. And what else? Oh, if you're going to be gone for a week, hold your mail. You can do that online with a lot of post offices.
Every post office, I think, at least in the U.S.
I've seen some where you can't do it online. You may have to fill out a form. But I had it at one point where mine did not and then it did. So, you can also get a form and put it in your mailbox and request it, or you can go to the post office. Because, a week's worth of mail could build up.
Yeah. Newspapers and all that, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Anything that the person, they basically hold it for you in a tray or whatever.
But here,
come and pick it up.
Here's something interesting. You cannot, you can get the Postal Service to hold your mail. You cannot. There is no way to notify UPS and FedEx that you are going to be gone and you want them to redeliver packages after you get back. If you're going to be gone for a week, if a package is to arrive on Monday and you're not back until Friday, you will not see that package. It will make it back to the sender as undeliverable. And I tried, I also tried, and I know I ranted about this here, tried to get them to forward anything that was sent to me at my old address to my new address. No, no way. Can't do it. Yada, yada, yada. So no, you can't, but you can make arrangements with the driver. If you know your drivers well enough, you can say, look, I'm going to be away. Put the stuff here. I've got somebody checking the house, put them there. But that's what you got to do. So there you go.
Okay. And then Pete, did Pete have some flying tips?
I think Pete's got some flying tips
too,
for us.
I've got one or two. I flew once.
Yeah, well, not once? This month.
Yeah. No, hey, now. Little seniority is a beautiful thing. I have.
You know what, Pete? I'm going to interrupt you there because it seems like I'm interrupting everybody tonight, so I might as well just roll with it.
Yeah.
And I want to tell everybody about our first sponsor here, Audio Engine at audioengineusa.com. The A2 speakers are what I'm speaking about this evening here because we got a great comment from Roger, a listener here, about the A2s. Now, the A2s are truly desktop speakers. They're two separate speakers. Inside each cabinet is a tweeter and a woofer, and then like a little bass resonance chamber. And these things sound huge. They sound great, and they are engineered for digital music. They have EQ'd them internally. They built the cabinets. They picked the right speakers, and they built them to really bring out all the sound that's there inside an MP3 file. And Roger writes, I just wanted to take a moment to thank you for the wonderful pair of Audio Engine A2 speakers that are sitting on my desk. A note from John and I. We did not send Roger A2 speakers. He bought them with his own money. For the first time since I packed away the component system and digitized my music, it actually sounds good in my office. Thank you for turning me on to this excellent product. La Via Strangiato
That's easy for you to say.
La Via Strangiato hasn't sounded this rich and full in ages. Keep up the great podcast. Sincerely, Roger. And always wonderful to encounter a fellow Rush fan. So Audio Engine USA, the A2 speakers are $199. You can get them in black or in white, and they'll plug right into your Mac or into your stereo system or into your iPod directly. Very flexible, just a standard audio input. AudioEngineUSA.com. And with that, now, Pete, uninterrupted Pilot Pete, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, for flying, if you're going to be particularly transcontinental, if you're going from the East Coast, you're going to be on a longer flight, I would bring a light snack or a sandwich, or even if you just buy one right at the airport shop, get a Subway or something along those lines. Most flights don't offer chow on the airplanes anymore, particularly in coach, sometimes in first class, and some of them offer it for sale. And the flight attendants do know the trick about, you got change for $100, they're going to have change for you, or they're not going to serve you. They're not going to get back to you a lot of times now. I've seen that happen a lot, and over the last couple of years, less and less effective. Bring a good book or a Mac magazine to read on the way, something to entertain yourself.
Maybe even a podcast to listen
absolutely.
To?
Absolutely.
Queer DVD? No, a podcast, you're right.
Yeah, good podcast. Now for the good tricks on the airplane, where do you want to sit? Well, if you're in steerage or coach, you want to get onto the bulkhead seats if you can. That's going to give you a little more leg room. And the, what'd you call them? The jerkwad or something? What was that? It was one of the tweets. The jackhole in front of me or behind me doesn't realize that, my back doesn't conform to his knee or something along those lines.
Yeah, that's right.
Kept kneeing you in the back.
Extra lumbar support there, free of charge.
But the guy in front of you won't send his seat back rapidly, thus crushing your MacBook Pro screen and sending it into hundreds of pieces. And if you do have seats in front of you, the next best seats you want to get are the exit row. Preferably, if there's two exit rows, you want to get the second one. The first exit row generally won't recline in order to make way for people exiting the airplane in a hurry. And if there's
you got to figure where the tray tables are for those two. I found that an interesting challenge. I'm like,
they're in the side.
Is it?
Yeah. And if you see smoke when they're starting the engines in cold weather, don't jump out of the airplane unless somebody tells you they're on fire. That happened recently.
Could be
Delta
steam,
Airlines
maybe.
Had an uncommanded evacuation right there at the ramp. It wasn't pretty.
Someone opened the door?
Yeah, I jumped right out and down. Yeah, there were people standing on the ramp, but that's another long story. We'll go into another day. They saw smoke while the engine was starting, and it's just condensed jet fuel that goes out that way early in particularly cold weather. Anyway, but I digress. So you're going to get more leg room in the second row exit seats and still get the ability to recline. Oh, let me back up before you get on the airplane. When you're dealing with the TSA, bring patience and a sense of humor. That will serve you well. And realize, aside from a select few, that the TSA people, and believe me, I've had steam coming out of my ears dealing with these folks. But the vast majority of them aren't being jerks because they enjoy being jerks. They've got rules they've got to follow, and they are being watched very closely. Their supervisors are all over them, and if they see them letting somebody go by, they're going to hear about it, and it's going to be in written performance reports and all kinds of nasty stuff. So they're generally speaking, they're just doing their job. They're not trying to be jerks because they can be, most of them. There's always the 10%, I guess, but No, they are. They're trying. It is an all security theater, in spite of it feeling that way so many times. When you get to the airplane, the gate agent is your best friend or your worst enemy. Your gate agent is, well, the airplane's at the gate. He is the judge, jury, and executioner. I told Dave earlier about a story. A guy actually sitting in 1B in first class, and I was sitting across from him. And the gate agent got the airplane. He's all ready to close the door. And he said to the guy in 1B, he goes, you know, I'm sorry about the misunderstanding back there, but, you know, things are all squared away. You got your seat now and enjoy your trip. And the guy, instead of going, oh, thanks for the apology, basically said, you should apologize to me. You were being a jerk. And I don't think he used quite as nice a word. You were being a jerk back there. The gate agent looked at him and went, okay, that's it. You're off the airplane. And the guy's jaw dropped a little bit. And he's like, well, I'm not getting off. He basically said, I'm either calling the cops and they're going to haul you off, or you can get off on your own. The choice is yours, sir. And the guy got up and left the airplane. They do have that kind of power. That being said, if you're in coach and they've got seats and they happen to remember you because you're nice to them, they if they're in a good mood, they may be able to help you.
Well, legally, you're supposed to observe any instruction given by any of the flight crew.
Absolutely. That's a federal law. Which is one of my other points. You know, when the flight attendant comes around and says, turn off the cell phone, it's going to interfere with the avionics, 98% of them don't know the technology works or doesn't work or any of that. They've been told that. They know it's a rule they have to follow and enforce. And they have to enforce it evenly or they lose complete control. They can't judiciously go, well, you look like you know what you're doing. It's okay for you to have your cell phone on and have somebody else in the seat behind chewing them out. Oh, you got to turn your cell phone off. It doesn't work.
Now, I have heard of cases, it's a little tangent, but I think it's relevant, where some devices can go into airplane mode where the RF is off. Like, I believe the iPhone will do this, yes?
Absolutely.
Correct.
Now,
but still,
I've heard of cases.
Taxi and takeoff and landing.
Right. Yes. But I've heard of cases where some people did not understand that you could disable the RF part. And discussion ensues, in which case it's not that important. Turn your device off.
It isn't. Yeah. Turn it off. You got to follow them. They're just doing their job. Again, you know, it's probably not the onboard flight leader. They're going to be more experienced, but the onboard flight leader is watching. And if somebody tells you to do something and they don't present it right, or if they don't tell you to turn it off when they probably should, the onboard flight leader is going to notice, and it's going to make it to their personnel file eventually. So they're just doing their job. They're just like you're doing your job, and you don't want grief from people. They're the same way, you know, and you're kind of all on the same team. You all want to, they just want to get to their layover and have fun, just like you want to get to Macworld and have fun. So let's see. Here's the other one I was thinking about. Here's how to get some freebies on the airplane, all right? And if you don't wind up getting freebies, you've still done a good deed and filled up your karma bank, and somewhere along the line, maybe you will. You see the gal going down the aisle, and she's hauling a stroller and a tow-behind suitcase and a screaming three-year-old and a baby in her arms. She's having a bad day. If you can give her a hand, do it. Not a big deal. She's obviously inexperienced, and you're going to see other inexperienced flyers. If you can give them a hand, get the airplane loaded a little quicker, the crew's going to notice that. And when it comes time to hand out drinks, if you're going to ignore John and Dave's device and partake in the alcohol, you may get a freebie there. So, if they don't notice and you don't get the freebie, you've filled up your karma bank for another day, I guess. And my last one, and this, I've done this a lot, and I can't think of a single time where I've actually taken cash out of my pocket to make this happen. But I always offer, when I see servicemen in uniform on the airplane, I offer to buy them a drink with the flight attendant. See, anything they want to drink, it's coming out of my pocket, offer it to them. I'm more than happy to pay for it. Every time I've done it, I've had the flight attendant say, no, I'll take care of that. I'll comp them. And thanks for offering. And since you offered, I'll comp you too. So it's a way to get a freebie.
Or fill up the karma bank.
Right, if they don't. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you, Pete.
And safe and fun travels.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah. You make a good point. If you go out of your way to help someone, it actually can make your experience better.
Absolutely.
Because you've done something that hopefully make somebody else feel good, and that'll make you feel good. And now you've got something that you can kind of coast on. If that buys you 30 minutes of happiness, man, that's a lot on a 3-hour flight.
Absolutely.
So,
or being purely selfish, if you help someone else load their stuff in the overhead bin while they're trying to sit down and settle themselves, everybody gets on the plane quicker and can leave.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right.
Beautiful thing.
Practical point of view. Okay.
All right. So once you get there, there are a couple of places that you can come and see John and I. So we are doing two podcasts live on the show floor. We'll probably do three podcasts there. We'll probably do one either Sunday night or Monday night. When do you get in, John? Sunday night? Is that right?
Sunday night. Okay. 5 or 6.
All right.
I think.
Well, we'll see how it goes. We may do kind of our typical, you know, 20-minute pre-show. We're here and we're ready and, you know, we're going to rock and all that good stuff. But then on Tuesday at 4:30 p.m. Pacific time, so local time at Macworld Expo, in the North Hall, booth 3036 is the Macworld Expo podcast stage. And there's a stage set up where John and I will be. There's chairs there. There's a PA system. And of course, we'll record it and release it for all of you that aren't there. But we're doing a Mac Geek Gab Live. This is open to anyone with an exhibit badge, which essentially is everyone. If you can get on the show floor, you can come to this. No problem. And we'd love to see you there. The focus of that show is going to be us talking about what we thought of the keynote. We will take questions live. So, we'll see how we do. We don't have the benefit of prepping your question before we answer it, but, we'll do what we can and have some fun with it. So total seat of our pants. That's right.
The worst that could happen is that it's a total washout.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. How much worse could it get than that? we will be doing that again on Thursday afternoon at 2:30 PM, same place. Same format, except instead of talking about the keynote, we're going to be talking about the things that we've seen on the show floor, the cool stuff that's out there, and anything else cool that we've seen at the expo. Sort of our wrap up of the show on Thursday. Thursday morning at 11 a.m., I'm doing my Running Your Mac Lean, Clean, and Mean session. Now, this requires a user's conference badge. I think there's or more. If you have a pro tools session badge or whatever, the all of that'll get you in. I think you've got to check your badge to see what it gets you into. But this is a conference session only in room 2001. That's over across the street in the West Hall, which is where all the big conferences are. So that's 11 a.m. Pacific on Thursday. One web resource I wanted to throw out there is the Hess party list. And we'll put a link to this in the show notes. Eileen Hoffman maintains the list of all the events that are happening at Macworld Expo. It started out as just a list of all the parties, and it still includes that. But it also includes things like our live appearances and book signings and all sorts of stuff like that. So if you're coming out, check this list. This is the place to look to find out what it is you are missing or what it is you might be able to do while you're there. It'll tell you if it's invitation only or how you need to get in or all that stuff. She's very, very comprehensive with it. She does this for free. She does have sponsors. I've been told that she told me today that she is accepting, I think, a $10 donation. So, do with that information what you may. But the Hess list is a great resource. So we get nothing for saying that other than knowing that you'll be informed. And also we've used it for years. So it's nice to kind of spread it all around. So that's it. Are we ready to move on to Catherine's question there, John?
Absolutely.
All right. All right. Were you sending me the Hess list while I was talking about it there, John?
Well, I can mention here. So if you Google for, Hess party list, I think that'll, yeah, Hess. Yeah.
H-E-S-S.
Or the URL for it is www.eileensmachine.com/partylist.shtml, which you'll find.
That's right.
So between those two things, you'll definitely find the list. It's probably the most comprehensive list of what's going on that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we've burned up quite a bit of time here, which is a good thing. I wouldn't say we burned it up. We've gotten through that much. It's time to slowly ease our way into the listener-supported version of the show here, and we have a question about Macworld Expo. And Catherine writes, I just made my reservations for my hotel in San Francisco. My hotel has free wireless access, and I was wondering about wireless safety. I know you've covered this subject before, but with so many people heading to hotels for maybe their first Macworld, I thought it might be a good idea to cover surfing hotels wireless safely, or just remind listeners and point them in the direction of past podcasts where you have previously covered this topic. So here we are for you, Catherine, and for anyone else. And John, you sort of started down this path with your Macworld tips, so I think we'll go right to you.
Okay, so I'll start off. I'm going to take maybe a different direction than we have in the past talking about this. And I would say if you have a choice, because I think in a lot of hotels you may, of wired versus wireless, with a caveat that we'll go into, I would choose a wired connection.
Yes.
Because I think it is relatively more secure if it's connected to a switch and the router or the switch is configured properly and it's not blasting your traffic all over the place, which... Wireless, on the other hand, unsecured wireless tends to let everybody see lots of things they probably shouldn't. Okay?
Yeah.
So that's my first tip. And I verified this. If you log in to a wireless access point without authenticating and you fire up something like Wireshark and look at the traffic, there's a lot of stuff there you are not supposed to see. Now, it could be that it's misconfigured or that's just the nature of it or a combination of both. So you may want to, as I mentioned before, maybe get a wired connection and bring along your own portable access point and be sure to enable some sort of encryption. No, not WEP, please, because that's close to useless. WPA2 personal, I think, is just fine. You know, don't use a stupid password. Maybe hide your access point if you don't want other people getting to it. Though, if you'd like to make friends and maybe share so you don't all pay, you know, some outrageous daily fee for internet access, then... maybe you do want to share, but be aware that your traffic, you know, maybe, you know, people may be able to see your traffic. If you're offered a wireless login via WPA, via hotel network, which I'm not aware a lot of them that do that, Dave, and maybe it's changing just with a heightened awareness, one would hope, of security. I mean, we've seen this on the show floor and stuff. They'll typically have a username and password, which is good. In that case, then you can be, you know, sure that your traffic between your computer and the wireless access point is secure. I guess another thing to mention is that if you have a VPN that you want to connect to, that provides an additional layer, and a lot of people recommend that in addition to having something like WPA2. It can't hurt to have extra encryption. And we've talked about some different VPN services. You can either provide your own or, you know, there are third-party VPNs. I guess the only thing with that is, you know, do you trust them or not? And we've had a lot of talk about trust and certificates and all of that. And do not connect to something that's named free public Wi-Fi. Most of you should know better than that, but just don't. what do you think of that?
Yeah, I agree. I'll throw one sort of left turn in there. When you connect to a wired connection and bring your own hotspot, either, you know, your own router or whatever it is, there's an added benefit. In addition to getting a wired connection that you then control the wireless from, you can connect your iPhone or iPod Touch to that connection. And essentially you're sharing a shared connection that can sort of wreak havoc if you're trying to do things like iChat, especially AV, you know, across Skype tends to be able to navigate that stuff. No problem. But iChat's a little pickier. But, you know, a lot of hotels will charge for each computer that you're connecting, and many of them will see your iPhone as its own computer. But, you know, as long as you don't have your router in bridge mode, well, now you've bridged that connection out, or now you've shared that connection and you're taking one connection from the hotel and sharing that amongst all your devices.
Oh, yeah, you definitely want to enable NAT. Yes,
right.
Okay, I agree with you, because a lot of times they may either not work, assuming that you're doing something weird, or maybe charge you double or triple because they see multiple computers.
Right.
Because sometimes, I've done that in the past where I think I hook up the wired machine, and then I realized, oh, I should have taken out my wireless access point. And they had two charges on my bill for access, and I'm like, well, you got to fix this. So like, well, there's two charges. I'm like, well, yeah, I can see that, but I only have one computer and I'm only one person. How could I possibly be using it twice?
That
and they're like,
doesn't.
Oh, you're right.
That
well, they took it
won't fly
off.
Anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
So you better turn on NAT mode, because NAT mode would eliminate that problem, because they the additional MAC address of whatever other device they saw would not be seen.
Yeah, I remember I stayed somewhere recently where it was made
did charge
very,
more.
It was made very clear that you were paying whatever it was, $9.99 a day for each computer, and the thing even said if you have two laptops, you will pay twice. So,
well, unless you. Again, have a device.
Right, but yeah, exactly. But they just wanted to make that clear so that when you saw your bill and you're like, two charges, this is crazy. You know, my internet for the room, not for the room, for each computer is how they specified.
Well, the hotel I was with at the point didn't have such draconian regulations.
Right. So. Right. Pete, did you have something to add there?
I do. Well, I have a question. Because I remember the first time I was setting up my Airport Express in a hotel room, I got the warning, and my Suntimer's disease is acting up. I can't remember what the warning was, but it was essentially saying you're using dual DHCP or dual NAT. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
And it says that, but that's what you want. You
yes.
want to accept that warning so that you let it give DHCP addresses to your items.
You know, I think there's one thing. Okay, so the address you get from the hotel may be a NAT assigned address. It may not be a real IP address.
Right.
I think there's a problem if both your airport and their address are using the same subnet. And I think we've seen this before, Dave. So if they're doing anything on 10.0.
There shouldn't be, because neither is routable. If the hardware is built to spec, neither is, if you're both in let's say 192.168.1, right? If you're both in that same subnet, it should still work because all routers know that those addresses are not routable.
I understand, but I don't know. I seem to recall a situation where both their network and my network were both tossing out addresses in the same 10.0.1. Whatever range, and it just wasn't working out. When I switched it over to a different, which the two others I think are 192 and 171. I forget.
Yep.
Then it got better. So I'm mentioning that as a potential, and maybe something on their network was misconfigured. But I'm saying there's a potential, you know, if you're having problems getting a NAT assigned address from your device, you should be able, I know it's on one of the screens, I don't have it right in front of me, you can specify which subnet it should be assigning the NAT addresses.
That's right.
Just want to mention it. It sounds like you haven't run into this. I have. So
yeah, but Pete's point is well taken. You want to let it do the double DHCP order to do this, and that's exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, so, and you only have to set it up once. The Express remembered it the next time I was in a hotel and went to do it. So
right. All right, it's time to get on to some follow up from last week's show. We talked about multiple monitors, John, and we gave some solutions. We had quite a few people write in, and we have an audio comment from Brent, but I think I'm actually just going to go straight to the, I guess, you know what, we can play both. Let's play the audio comment, and then we'll follow up with Jeff's email, which really kind of adds some crystallization to this.
Hey, John and Dave, this is Brent from Southern Mississippi. I was listening to the latest podcast, and you know, we're talking about hooking up external monitors, more dual or triple external monitors to, say, a MacBook Pro. I happen to have a MacBook Pro, and I've done a little research on this. I came across a company called Matrox, and they have a couple of products, a dual head and a triple head to go. This allows a user to connect two monitors or three monitors to, say, a MacBook Pro using either VGA or DVI connections. This is just another addition to some of the products that y'all had already mentioned that uses the USB bus. This right here is an external, it almost looks like a KVM, but I'd encourage the listeners to check it out. Look it up, Matrox, dual head or triple head to go. Thanks, guys. Love the show.
Absolutely. Thanks, Brent. And I'll say thanks in advance to Brent for, because I believe this is the same Brent that is converting this week's show into AAC for us. So assuming it comes out in AAC, we can all say a big thanks to Brent. Jeff writes in about the same thing. At the time, I looked at the display link, but from what I had read, the Mac drivers were quite buggy. And the display link was the thing that you and I had talked about last week, John, the thing you had found, that the USB device that allows monitors to be connected. read that the Mac drivers were quite buggy with people experiencing problems. They did update their drivers earlier this month, but they still say OpenGL, Quartz Extreme, Quartz Composer, and other framework based on OpenGL will not be fully supported. From what I have read earlier, they wanted Apple to help them get the drivers to be better, but were pretty much ignored. Of course, any solution that relies on USB 2.0 is going to be less than optimal because of bandwidth. A better solution is the same thing Brent recommended, the Matrox Dual Head to Go or Triple Head to Go, which can add two or three monitors. He says the dual head version can give you two 19 by 20 by 1200 monitors. So in his experience, this is a much better solution. Now, I have a question about this, and I throw it out there to Jeff and Brent and any of the other listeners that wrote in or that know about this. The MacBook Pro can do external display resolutions up to 2560 by 1600 pixels. Now, when you plug in one of these Matrox devices plugs into the single DVI port on your laptop, and then it breaks it out into two monitors from there. But your computer is only going to see it as one monitor, or perhaps we'll see it as two if you've got some special driver software that allows it to see what's happening. But either way, that DVI port can only support 2560 by 1600 pixels. So I'm not sure how you're getting two screens of 1920 by 1200 out of that. And I'd be curious to hear if anybody has actually done that. Maybe Jeff has, and I'd love to hear back from Jeff. Do you have any thoughts on that there, John?
Well, I wonder if the device itself is somehow...
It can't, right?
I'm speculating that, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Right. I mean, I see it's connected to the DVI port and the USB port, so I don't know if it's somehow extending or has its own video memory that it's somehow buffering between. I mean, it's possible. I don't know the specs for a DVI port, so maybe it's, the box, you know, duplicates the creates an additional channel or circuit or whatever. It's I'm probably not being too clear, but looking at the diagram here, that's about the only thing I could imagine that they're doing. Because also I noticed they say up to 1920 by 1200.
Right.
Though it would seem here looking at the picture that yes, there are two 19 by 12 screens.
Interesting.
So interesting. I have not read in detail about this, so I'll have to look. Well, they have a tech specs and all that. Well, I don't know if they'll be at the show. I don't think they're going to be at the show. So.
Yeah, I don't know if they are. I could check my iMacWorld app on the iPhone.
Oh,
here, John.
Yeah.
You know, if we vamp long
enough.
Wasn't
a new version coming out?
I heard that.
Didn't he just release a new version? Or it's being approved?
It's right, sent to the App Store for approval. So presumably by about February 1st, we ought to see that come right out, don't you think? That seems to be about how long it takes. So
And that's right. I just got an iPod Touch, so I'll be able to load up all those cool apps.
Yeah. Matrox, no. Not on the list, at least not on the current list. So I clicked the button that's supposed to go and update the data, and it's still not there. So there you go.
And I'm looking at the list on, on the website. Don't see them. Maybe next year.
As a follow-up to our talk last week on certificates, and especially the extended validation certificates, we got a couple of emails from Scott, our resident security, or not resident.
Alpha geek.
Well, and this is the kind of stuff he does for a living. So Scott's actually called in with a voicemail and then sent in about a 10-minute audio comment. I'm not going to play the whole audio comment. In fact, I think his voicemail, at least the first minute or two of it here, really sort of encapsulates what it was he was trying to say. He goes into some great detail. And Scott, man, we got to get you on the podcast to talk about this stuff, because playing a 10-minute audio comment, we can't really do. But doing an interactive chat, where we're talking about it, that would be great. So we got to break this this pattern of not doing interviews, John. And I know we've done some and here and there, but we got to do more. And so maybe that's our Mac Geek Gab. Can we make that our Mac Geek Gab New Year's resolution for 2009?
Yes.
Or at least we'll make it that we'll make that resolution in 2009 for 2010, right? let's play a little bit of this, John, and share with him some of what Scott said, and then we'll sort of, when it gets to the point where he's sort of crystallized it, we'll stop his comment and talk about it a little bit.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Scott in D.C. First of all, happy holidays. And let me see if I could help you from something from number 182 regarding certificates, with all due respect to Sinclair, who posed the question, and to Steve Gibson of GRC. I have actually worked with PKIs and set up PKIs and run PKIs and so on and so forth. Let me explain. It is the whole concept of a PKI is a matter of trust. Once a certificate is issued by a certification authority, it is up to the user to decide what trust means. The problem with this, and the problem with the way it was set up, is that everybody had its context of concept of trust. So when SSL came out and everybody jumped on the SSL bandwagon and people were issuing SSL certificates, there was a multitude difference in trust. In fact, while you were using VeriSign as an example, VeriSign has something called a Class 3 certificate. And a Class 3 certificate can be bought with nothing more than a credit card, and it's issued to the person who owns the credit card. Now, of course, you could have a stolen credit card and have the certificate issued in the name of the stolen credit card name, but that's another story. So there was no way of knowing the level of validation for the certificates. Now, like John said, you can go back and go through the keychain and manually set, well, I'm not going to trust a Class 3 certificate. Well, the problem is maybe 70 to 80% of the people on the web were using Class 3 certificates because it was easy, rather than going through the identification and proofing process. That's the whole point of the extended verification certificate. It creates a standard for the verification process. Along with the extended verification process, there's some additional information that is being put into the certificates. So the certificate headers are a little bit bigger because there are optional fields that are being used under the EV standard.
Okay, and I'm going to stop Scott there. We could let it go, and there's great information coming until his voicemail actually gets cut off. I think his cell phone got cut off. But I think what he just said there, John, is the key takeaway here, that EV creates a standard for extended verification. So everybody's doing it the same way. And you know that if you get one of these certs, it's done to the same level of verification no matter who it is that issued it. And so it really tries to kind of bring this together. I'm sure you have something to add. I know you have something to add.
I agree. And I had not realized. There are different, I guess what he's saying, there are different classes of certificates, and you cannot be totally sure that their methods of verification are comprehensive. EV resets the bar. So if you, in Safari, the text turns green, in IE on Windows, you see a green bar at the top. With other products, you'll see something indicating this is different from other SSL sites. So I agree with him, though. I don't think this says that you cannot trust any non-EV site, but you should be more careful, which, of course, leads to the question, how do you know any better?
Right.
And you really don't. But unfortunately, not everybody is on the EV bandwagon. I think he mentioned a few people, eBay, I think, perhaps, PayPal.
Yep.
And some other people, and of course VeriSign, have latched onto this, but there's going to be a transition period, so it's kind of an uneasy time, and people should, we'll find something talking about EV. It's going to take a while for the world to all switch over to EV, and then you have a new level of trust.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I don't know that the whole world ever will. I mean, let's take us, for example, the thing that I was talking about, the SSL cert that we use internally here. You know, I paid $50 for 2 years worth at GoDaddy, and I have no reason to pay $500 a year for an EV certificate for the purposes that we're using. Now, I need this to be trusted by the browsers automatically. So I can't just create my own certificate internally. I have to use one that goes through a certificate authority.
Well, you could, but then you'd have to populate all the machines that you want to talk to you with that cert, and that's an unwieldy, not impossible, but a pain in the neck.
For this purpose, it's not possible. So, because of the way we're using the certificate, it simply is not an option. So I have to use one, but I'm going to do it the cheapest way I can because the whole world's not using this. This server, the people that I hand this server address to for the purposes they're going to use it, they're going to trust me. I just want their data encrypted, right? I don't, the data that they're passing back and forth, I want it to be encrypted. So I have to use an SSL cert. And again, I have to use one that's issued by an authority that's built into, all the common browsers and Safari and all that stuff. And so I went to GoDaddy, but it's what, 5% of the price, right, that I would pay by going with an EV cert. It's not worth it. Mm-hmm. I don't need the green bar to show up and say Backbeat Media there. It's not important. Until the browsers stop supporting the old certificates. And then, of course, it becomes imperative, at which point I'll pay my $500.
Now, another facet to that is that the latest Safari has a tab or has a feature now in the security tab titled Warn When Visiting a Fraudulent Website. And I believe that's actually tying back to a Google database of likely either phishing or just, spyware laden sites. And if you try to go to them and you this may have happened to you, if it has, then it's doing its job. Hopefully it'll say, this site is suspect. Are you really sure you want to go here? And it'll let you if you say yes. And hopefully the user will not fall into the trap of clicking yes on anything that they see, which is how a lot of things work in reality. You see an error message that says, do you want to do this? And you're like, yeah, okay.
Right.
It could say the world will end if you click okay. And I've seen studies done on this. People usually ignore the warnings. They just want to get to their shopping or whatever they're trying to get to.
Right. They want to hand out their credit card to whoever it is that wants it.
That's an interesting addition that they made in the latest Safari. So it's kind of neat to see these little changes. So now they got, that feature and they have, EV certification in that you'll see green text next to a site if it's using EV cert. So Safari's kind of keeping up with the rest of the pack, I think.
Yep. Our second sponsor for this show, John, is Audible. If you visit audiblepodcast.com/MacGeekGab, you'll be brought to a page where you can sign up for Audible, get a 2-week free trial, and download a free audiobook. Now, for those of you who don't know, Audible is a huge repository of audiobooks. It's a commercial repository. You can buy the books there. They're all great quality. You can preview them before you buy. It links with iTunes, so it'll sync to your iPod, your iPhone. You can burn it to CD. You can basically anywhere that you could play this podcast, basically you could play your Audible content. And so these are audiobooks. You can hear what they sound like. Make sure you like the author's not necessarily the author, but the narrator's voice, and off you go. One book, I did that interview with Waz recently, John. The iWaz book is the book that he wrote or co-wrote, I guess. And it's read by a professional voice actor out there. And a great little book about how Waz sort of started off in this crazy world and how he started off this crazy world. So that's iWaz, available at Audible. You could get that for free. Go sign up right now. You could have it with you on your iPod or iPhone on the airplane as you're coasting over the country off to San Francisco for next week's Macworld Expo. So audiblepodcast.com/MacGeekGab.
Is he going to be there, you think? You think he'll pop in?
Yeah, well, he told us. We asked him if he would be there, and he said, yeah, I'll be there. He said, I like to go to the keynote if I get VIP treatment, he said, because it's great. He says it's like cutting in line, but it's prearranged. So he says it's great. I don't have to wait in line. I just show up and they walk me to my seat. And he says, I
would
like
hope
that.
Him of all people would get a good seat.
I'm guessing it's not a guarantee, or at least it wasn't when we were talking to him a couple of weeks ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So I guess, and we didn't talk to him about this, but from some of the research I did, I guess he's technically still an employee of Apple in
I
so much
he was
as
a fellow or something. Like,
right. Exactly. He's a fellow
technical. Yeah.
So he gets a paycheck and health insurance probably, you know, that, but he, to my knowledge, he has not shown up for work or had a job at Apple since 1987, I think. And I don't think he has any intention of going back there. You know, I think it's okay. Sort of,
well, it'd be nice to see him. Well,
yeah.
We saw him last year.
Yeah. My guess is he'll show up on his Segway and then, you know, kind of blow past the line and go in and be walk to his seat just like he always is. So. And then he says as soon as the keynote's over, he's got to get out of there. Otherwise, the press hunts him down and he says something, the wrong thing. And then, you know, the stock price sort of flutters because Woz said something that he shouldn't have. And then Jobs calls him and yells at him. So,
OK, well, we'll get the TMO mobile to take care of this problem.
Yeah, that's right. So that's Audible. Audiblepodcast.com/MacGeekGab. You can go get the iWoz book and hear all about what Steve Wozniak did when he was starting things off. All right. We have time for a couple of just regular questions. Do we, John? Do you want to do? I think we got to skip down maybe to the desktop one there, because that's probably a quicker answer than digging too deep into the one of the first one or two. Or what do you think?
Desktop
John?
Who?
James.
Where is he? I don't see him. Hold on.
Get your agenda out. You go to MISC questions, right? Halfway down the thing there. We just finished the Audible sponsorship.
All the way down there.
Well, that's where we are. We finished. We're knocking these things out, man.
Oh, hold on this, Chris. James, I'm sorry. Yes. Okay, James. Oh, I feel bad about skip. Well, we'll get back to it.
We can get back to it. Do you want to do Chris and James? Is that the trick? Or maybe we'll do James and Kelly. We'll do James and Kelly. That's what we'll do. But Chris and...
Chris.
Chris could be quick enough, right?
Chris, James, and Kelly. How about that?
Okay.
Can we do it quick? Okay.
Let's see what happens. We'll start with Chris. Chris writes... I was listening to one of your most recent podcasts where you had the dreaded audio burbles, a problem that you suspected was due to a buffer issue induced by Time Machine. I myself just purchased my first Intel-based MacBook Pro and was wondering about potential performance problems with Time Machine enabled. One potential solution I thought of was setting up the machine with two user accounts. One would be my everyday account, in which I do all my email surfing and pre-production work like writing and photo editing. This account would have Time Machine enabled and would be backed up regularly. Second account would in theory be more of a live production account that will be used for presenting keynote or PowerPoint slideshows, recording audio, or triggering lighting cues. This second account would not have Time Machine enabled and might have other things like Bluetooth AirPort and even virus scanning disabled to maximize performance and minimize processor overhead during showtime. Would this strategy work? Is Time Machine account-centric to allow this sort of Hannah Montana-esque alter ego scheme? Clearly, Chris has a daughter about the age of mine.
Yeah, because I know that you've checked out the shows, and yeah, I'll give you a pass on that because you have a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
If I was at those shows, it'd just be creepy. So
yes, that's right. That's right. Okay, so to answer, I'm going to answer the first part of this. And the first part, John, is Time Machine. It's not just Time Machine that was the problem here. The Time Machine, the issue is, right now we're recording the show, which means we're recording to the hard disk inside the iMac. Anything. And so as we're talking, the audio is just constantly being dumped out to the hard disk in full uncompressed AIFF format. So not an insignificant amount of drive activity. It's not huge. It's not totally taxing the drive, but it's something.
I want to try to take a step back. Can I try just for a bit here? I'm going to interrupt you.
Yeah, go ahead. Go. I'll take my own medicine.
But I think it'll make this a bit clearer. So let us look at a computer system in general, okay? You have memory, processor, hard drive, and maybe some other things like sound and all that. And the thing is, they all talk to each other for the most part through something we'll call a bus, okay? And you see in references to this in the technical documentation for the computer, a bus is this fast, or you know, however many megahertz and all that. The thing is that you have this subtle combination of both the capability of the bus, which can only move so much data in a certain amount of time, and maybe some support chips, like an audio chip or a hard drive chip or something connected to that bus, and then the software that may influence how that chip behaves. And the thing is, when they all have to interact, and I think I'll try to bounce it back to you, but I think what you're hinting at is that there's this dance between all of them, or maybe you weren't hinting at that. I just kind of presented that bigger picture that they're all trying to get along with each other, and sometimes it may not work out. So hopefully that was somewhat helpful.
I think so. Yeah, that's exactly where I was going with this. Right. So as part of the recording process, we're just constantly dumping audio out. Now, presumably what's happening, and I don't know this for certain, but I'm pretty sure, is that the audio sort of fills up a disk buffer, and then it writes out a chunk all at once, and then it fills up that buffer and writes out the chunk. So it's not just constantly trickling data out. It's sort of dropping data out, right? Right. Droplets of water. Think of it that way. Well, if suddenly an operation happens that needs to either read a bunch of data from the disk or write a bunch of data to the disk, that could get in the way here. And like you were saying, John, earlier, you know, disk activity sort of trumps all. So if the buffer gets full, then, and it can't write out when it thinks it needs to write, then suddenly everything backfills and you folks hear that lovely stuttering sound that you've come to know and love.
Or we said that in the pre-show, and I guess having done, it's been a while, but having done some, you know, digital design and just, you know, system architecture, trying to understand things. If I was an operating system or a computer and I had to decide between successfully reading data from or writing data to a disk and maybe dumping some audio that is not life-threatening. To me, a lot of times I would say disk access is pretty darn important. You want to do that accurately. Whereas, hey, so what I'm saying is if I had to make a decision between the two again, I would rather not provide full sound performance in order to provide necessary and maybe critical to the operation of the computer, like swap files and stuff like that, disk services. So I think a lot of times, and I think we've all noticed this, when your disk is being accessed, especially if you use our friend menu meters and you see both the read and the write light on, that's why your computer is a pig and it's a dog, whichever animal you choose, a snail, a turtle. That's why it's so unresponsive, because it's whomping on the hard drive. And I think that usually has the highest priority of any device in the system, certainly not the audio circuits, or at least not unless you have a dedicated audio card, in which case maybe that has enough juice to, you know, and buffers things like you were referring to, Dave. If you have a dedicated audio card, and I don't know if you've played with those or you just tend to use the built-in stuff. I mean, I'm sure there are third-party audio cards, which maybe if you want massive sound buffers can get around this problem. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be fair, I think the buffers in the Mac can actually be made quite big. The trick is I don't want them big, because what I'm doing right now is monitoring the signal post effects and post in any processing. And in order to do that live, I need the buffers to be relatively short. Otherwise, I'm hearing myself on a delay that's simply too much. I'm currently hearing myself on a delay. It's a split second, but it does take a bit to get used to. Doing it on a half a second delay makes it nearly impossible. So if you've ever tried to listen to yourself on delay, like talk into a microphone and hear yourself on delay in headphones, it'll totally screw you up. In fact, I remember hearing that insurance companies will take, if someone comes to them and says, okay, yeah, I got hurt and there was a loud noise and I'm now deaf in my right ear, they'll say, okay, they'll sit you down, they'll put a pair of headphones on you, put a microphone in front of you and say, okay, start reading from this page. And you start reading and about the second and a half mark into your right ear, they'll pump your audio from a second and a half ago. And they just sit and watch. And if you stop dead in your tracks, they know it's because you heard yourself and your brain sort of fritzed out and didn't know what to do. If, of course, you're deaf in your right ear, you'll keep going. Or if you've trained yourself to get used to this, then you'll just learn to ignore it and move on. But it is a very conscious effort, especially initially, to get used to hearing that delay. So because of that, long story short, we keep the delays short. That keeps the buffers short. It offers us very little wiggle room when Time Machine kicks in and starts doing all sorts of stuff. Add to that, now Time Machine's reading data from the drive. As soon as I go play an audio comment, now that's also reading data from the drive. And then trying to play, trying to also record to the drive. It's too much at once and something has to go. And so that's what happens. So, all right. So it's not Time Machine's fault, Chris, but it is disk activity. No, I don't think Time Machine can be disabled per user. It is on per machine, but it's fairly easy to turn off. You just go in and switch the slider off when you're going to do some critical stuff like I should have done tonight, but I have not. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you can Hannah Montana your machine quite that degree. And there you go. I don't think there's an answer there, but at least now maybe you understand what's going on.
You know, I'm actually surprised because, you know, when I was up visiting you, Dave, we went to the, local toy store.
Yeah.
I'm surprised there's not a Hannah Montana Mac because there seems to be a Hannah Montana everything else.
That's interesting.
Man. Yeah. On the one hand, it's scary. On the other hand, I'm a Disney stockholder and
the more
Hannah Montana stuff they can push, hey, better for me.
Isn't that going to be in the keynote at Macworld? You guys let the cat out of the bag.
Phil told us to keep it secret, John.
That makes me cry.
All right. We're going to have to split the difference on this one. We've got time for James. Kelly will wait till the next show. So James writes, I've come across an interesting situation. I was cleaning some things up on my Mac and I noticed that my desktop folder was over 15 gigabytes in size. For the life of me, I cannot find where the size is at. I have attached a screen capture of the desktop folder showing a 15.56 gigabyte in size with only 5 items on the desktop that add up to about 30 megabytes. Do you think the 15 gigabyte is an accurate measurement or any, and if so, any suggestions on how to find the file or files that may be taking up that space? And sure enough, his screenshot, presuming it's not doctored in any capacity that would change the facts, shows a 15.56 gigabyte desktop folder and there's 5 files in it yet. So there's something going on here.
Did not add up. I would say it's either not so bad news or really bad news.
Mm-hmm. It might be really good news, right? I mean, he might have, 15 gigs that he's going to get back.
Can I start with worst case?
Yeah.
Okay, really bad news is the part of your disk that keeps track of how big things are is totally hosed. In which case, I would recommend, first off, try to make a backup, which you should always be doing with Time Machine and things like that, or whatever means you want to use, Super Duper,
yep,
Carbon Copy Cloner or something. This could be an indication that something's going wrong. Or another thing that actually I just got an update for, which should warn against these things, Smart Reporter. If your drive supports Smart, which is a protocol where the computer asks the hard drive, how you doing? And it says either everything's great or I'm starting to die, to sum it up. But I would say it could be a sign of damage. So back up anything you can, which you should always be doing anyways. Maybe start off with booting from a system disk and running disk utility.
Yep.
And do a repair because it could be one of these, I don't know if it's a B tree or some file that keeps track of how big files are. It could be hosed. Disk utility may be able to set things right, along with a lot of other utilities. Like, I think, Dave, you like Disk Warrior, I think, is your favorite. I tend to like Drive Genius for a lot of things. So that's the worst case, in that the data on the hard drive is corrupted and it's reporting what it thinks is accurate, but it certainly is not. Now, I'll let you go with the not tragic case, Dave.
Yeah, I would say that assuming tragedy hasn't stuck, that yes, it is accurate. And what it's showing you is accurate, right? It's showing you that the desktop folder contains, 15.5 gigabytes of files. And then it's showing you the files in the desktop folder, the 5 files that are there, and they add up to about 35 megs or 30 megs or whatever it is. So obviously there's a disconnect here. How can they both be right? Well, we have to bear in mind that files can be marked invisible. And if a file is marked invisible,
How would I know? If it's invisible, I can't see it.
That's right. Well, if it's marked invisible, then it should not show up on the desktop, but certainly should be included in the count of the size of a folder. How are you going to go find this? Well, my default is to go to the command line and I would open up terminal and I would type, when you open terminal, it brings you to your home folder. So you have sort of a shortcut here. You can type CD space desktop with a capital D. That will bring, and then press enter. That will bring you to your desktop folder. If at that point, then you do LS space dash L HA or LHAT, as I like to do, you'll see all the files in your desktop folder including the hidden ones. It'll show you the size of them, and that size will be in human-readable format. Everything will be organized in date order. So LS space das dash LHAT, L hat. And you can look there and see. And maybe is there a way to do it by size? I think there there probably isn't.
S?
No, it's not S. Mm-hmm. I wish it was.
That's my guess.
Yeah.
But if you're in the terminal, now one thing I think you mentioned, Dave, I think you said CDDE enter. I think you meant tab, right?
CD.
To get to the desktop folder, you could say CD begin with a folder that is within that folder. And if you type a couple of characters and hit tab, it'll
yeah,
be autocomplete.
I didn't want to make an assumption that that a folder that they only have the default folders in there. So I just said type CD space desktop with a capital D. And type the whole word out. Let me look here and see. I'm looking at the, I use the things that I use so often.
LS, and there's about 100 different.
And that's what I was looking at. I was looking at the man file for the LS.
Yeah, so it's sort files by size. Dash capital S.
Capital S, right. So LS space dash LHA, all lowercase, and then capital S will sort by size. And then if you just look at the top of the list, you can see what's the biggest file out here. The other thing you want to look for are any directories out there. So that's going to be. Each line is going to start with 10 characters, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, potentially 11 characters, showing you the permissions on the file. If the first one is a dash, the first character of the line that shows you the file is a dash, it is a file. If it's a D, it's a directory. And in order to get the size of the files in there, the easiest way is to do a CD space and then the name of that directory. And that'll bring you one level deeper. And then you do this LS space dash LHA capital S again, and you're there. So that's the way I would do it. I think a program like Omni Disk Sweeper will also find hidden files. So that might be an easier way to do this.
And just Onyx or some other things, I think they have it buried within all the subtle settings. I think a lot of them have show invisible files as a as an option, where I think it shows them kind of grayed out. So you can kind of tell that they're invisible.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You could turn them on with Onyx and see them in the Finder. That's absolutely right. It'll cause a relaunch of the Finder. But yeah, so Onyx would do that. You could skip the terminal entirely. Omni Disk Sweeper is a great way of finding not just these files here, but any files on your drive that are taking up a lot of space. And if you pay for it, then you have the option of actually deleting them. So, and that I think brings us to the point where I go out and find the band, which,
where'd they go?
Well, it was warm yesterday.
Under a huff?
What's that? They left in a huff?
Hey, how would they get in touch with you?
Oh, thanks, Pete.
Gosh. Wow.
See, this is part of the reason that we keep Pete here, because he makes it so that we don't forget these things.
Oh, there are so many ways to reach us, Dave, though, and I think the first is probably email.
It is. Are we supposed to now sing the old song? What was that? Reach out and touch someone, right?
No.
What was that from?
We're not a show. That's for Yellow Pages, AT&T.
AT&T years ago, wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah. Email. Now they don't come out and touch you so much as... No.
Just with the bill every month, John. And that's
email
not a gentle
is,
touch.
Yeah. Email is, I remember it now, it's feedback@macgeekab.com.
That's right. Excellent.
And you can email, or you could, of course, attach an audio comment. But if you just want to submit an audio comment, Dave, how?
You could call us, pick up your phone, pick up your iPhone, pick up your landline. You can pick up whatever kind of phone you want and dial 206-666-GEEK, which is...
We all know it's 4335.
That's right. And you can leave us a message there. John and I both get that. John and I both get everything emailed to feedback@macgeekgab.com. If you email either of us individually, John and I both don't get that. We don't want each other's email, except if it's coming from you. So please send to feedback@macgeekgab.com. That way we'll both get it.
Unless you're a stalker and you just want to approach one of us, then...
Sure. Yeah, but it's funny. I do get plenty of emails sent to me only that say, "Hey, John and Dave." And it's like, okay, No problem. You know, I file it in with the show stuff and mix it in when I'm going through the show. But John never sees that unless it's part of the show. So, and I'm sure you get the same thing because I think you've brought stuff in and it's like you get those
I
emails.
Have and I copy you. Yeah. Where it's usually something that I talked about or focused on. And they're like, oh, okay, I'll send it to John. So, yeah, right. It does all of us a favor.
Yeah. Yeah. You can Skype to Mac Geek Gab, all lowercase at Skype. And, of course, we love them iTunes comments. So send those along. Macworld Expo is January 5th through 9th. Please.
Yow.
Yeah.
It's a
that's on Monday.
It's less than a week.
Yeah, man.
Oh, it is a week.
Yeah.
Well, no, by this time next week, we're going to be... what are we going to be doing? I don't know. We may be doing...
Maybe doing a podcast.
A pre-show podcast. Or I heard there was something. Is it the 11th Street Grill?
Oh, there's the Smile on My Mac part,
too. Fourth... Well, no, Sean mentioned there was like an informal get-together. Is it 11th Street something or 4th? I forget.
I don't know. 4th Street Bar and Grill in the lobby of the Marriott there? Yep. Yep.
Or there's some place where, I'm sure it's on the event list.
Yes. Yes.
But yeah, there are all sorts of informal things. And again, like we said, don't wear yourself out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we did that at a podcast expo, Dave. I think you and I got on the bus with Dusty and started pouring drinks with good mixers and... The hours just melted away, and then it's 3 a.m., and you're like, oh, my gosh, I got to do something tomorrow.
I have a meeting in 4 hours or something. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so moderation is usually good. And in the case of an event like this where, I think a lot of us get all tuckered out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pace yourself, and you'll have a great time.
There you go. All right, CashFly Hosting is the provider of all the bandwidth for Mac Geek Gab. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebones Software, Disc Label from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and, of course, a free book and 2 free weeks from audiblepodcast.com/MacGeekGab, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. And I think the next time we're talking to you, it's coming from the left coast.
Yes, sir. Oh, man. You know what we're doing?
What are we doing?
We're getting on a plane. Where are you going out of Logan or?
I'm scheduled to fly out of Logan on Friday.
Yeah.
I couldn't get a direct flight though. I'm still trying to weasel that. Maybe somebody that works for American Airlines can help, huh?
I think I'm flying with them.
Yeah, they're good. I like them.
But when you're in the airport with the TSA, Dave.
Yeah, don't get caught, man.
Made up.